Nicknames are fun, eh, Greg Wyszynski?
Can you please call me Wish? That is, after all, my nickname. Yes,
sorry,
Wish.
And, I don't know, mine used to be Jeffy when I worked with, Waters, on the Leafs Lunch program. I was having a conversation yesterday doing the Calgary Flames, Chicago Blackhawks game on Sportsnet with my producer, Paul Bromby. We were talking about Colby Armstrong. I don't know how we got on the discussion of Colby Armstrong, but somehow the nature of the conversation led to Colby Armstrong. And the conversation revolved around this question. Colby Armstrong's nickname is Army, yet his first name is Colby. You could make the argument, I think rightfully so, that he doesn't need a nickname because his first name is itself a nickname. Where in hockey, you just kind of end every name with a Y, and that becomes your nickname. What's the point of calling him Army? If his nickname is already his first name, or vice versa, what's the point of him having a nickname when essentially Colby is a nickname in itself?
It's a double nickname. You're double dipping on the nicknames. I think the other example might be a guy like Bates. But remember Bates Battaglia?
Yeah.
Now, Bates is a nickname. His first name is Jonathan. Yeah. But I guarantee you that in any locker room that man sulked through during his time in the National Hockey League, it was not Bates. It was probably Tags.
Or BB.
Or BB. Right.
BB was the other one.
Bates is a nickname, though. I mean, in and
totally
of itself is a nickname. Right.
I know. What is his real first name? Is that
Jonathan.
His real first? Jonathan. Okay, so that is in itself.
Jonathan Battaglia here. Jonathan Battaglia, Action News.
So whose grandfather, for those that may not know this, and Wish, I'm sure that you do. Oh, sorry, Greg Wyszynski, I'm sure that you do. His grandfather worked with Al Capone.
Shh.
It's a true story.
Wait, really?
Yeah, Bates Battaglia. Look it up, dude. Off to Google for you, young man.
Is he the guy who got hit by the bat? Some of us don't know how to be team players, apparently.
That's what I love about baseball. And when the man's at the plate, it's a time for individual achievement, but he's still playing for a team. That's why I love baseball.
Now, I think we've talked before about how the great era of nicknames in the National Hockey League has probably passed us by. And I think part of that it's a corporate reason. No, but it was a corporate reason why. I feel like Ovechkin, Ovi, right? Or Grade 8 or Alexander the Great. Like, I believe that there is probably an organic nickname for him. But the problem is that he's got so many sponsors and so many guys trying to pimp his shit that it becomes 17 different nicknames. And the worst part about Ovechkin is that his friends, like Semin, call him Sasha. And now, that's very confusing for me as an American because we know him as Ovi or AO or Alex. So when you Sasha it, especially when Semin's name is Sasha too, it becomes very confusing.
What do you think the worst nickname is? Because for me, it's always, I remember I had this conversation with, well, ironically enough, Cassie Campbell a couple of years ago when I was doing a Montreal game. And we're going to get to Montreal later, folks. Don't worry, we're not ignoring the issue. And we were talking about nicknames. Said, Cassie, were you one of those people that just got called Soups or Soupy? She's like, listen, Jeff, everyone, whether it's Cassie Campbell or Brian Campbell, our nickname is automatically Soupy. It doesn't matter what you try to change it to, what anyone tries to change it to, it's either Soups or Soupy. That goes to our question of the day. The laziest nickname in hockey has to be Soupy.
It's got to be Soupy, or really, as a lot of people are pointing out, and we'll get to a lot of these later on, anything that has just a Y added to the end, anything that has just an R added to the end. I'll give you two that have always bothered me, and they're New York-centric. The first is Hank. For Henrik Lundqvist. And I know kind of a cool little shorthand and what have you, but King Henrik is so regal and so becoming of a man of his style and qualifications that when I hear Hank to me is a guy working at the docks. King Henrik, well, you've got a substantial nickname then. The other name that always bothered me was Gomer. For Scott Gomez. And I know this is because he's a hockey player, and as a hockey player, you just add an R where the Z is, and you've got yourself a nickname. But Gomer is, I mean, come on, man. Gomer is the nickname you give to the slow guy down the street. You know what I mean?
I know.
Hey, Gomer.
Know.
You know, that's the, I didn't really fit. Now, granted, there's a lot of Devil fans who think Gomer is completely applicable given the way he plays. But I think that overall, there are probably 1,000 different nicknames you could give a Hispanic guy from Alaska before you have to go to Gomer.
It's just an easy one, and it's a lazy one, right? Like, it's just too simple. It's not creative. Like, the Grim Reaper was a creative name. You know, Bundy for Warren Reichel or Chris Terrian, that's a pretty cool name. Roadrunner for Yvonne Cornway, that's a pretty
cool name. And a thousand different variations of Rocket. You had the Rocket, you had the Pocket Rocket, you had the Russian Rocket. I love that. It's beautiful.
Hang on. While you're talking about rockets, there was a third Richard brother. Was it Jean Potvin or Jean Richard? I got to look it up. I can't. I'm blanking on his name. You know what his nickname was? Because there was the Rocket. There was the Pocket Rocket, and you know what his nickname was?
What?
The Vest Pocket Rocket.
It's
true. I ain't making this up. Hang on, I'm gonna
Did they have a sister? Because right this whole rocket, pocket rocket business. quick tweet from Jesse Kuhn about Alex Goligoski. I like this one. Goligoski was frequently called Go-Go by media and fans, but went by Goose in the Room. Nobody who knew him called him Go-Go. Now that's a very good point. Sometimes there is definitely a separation point between fans and media and what they actually call these cats inside of the room. I have definitely referred to Goligoski as Go-Go in a post or two, and it would not surprise me that a grown man in a hockey locker room is not nicknamed Go-Go unless it's for a very specific post-game reason.
Still looking up the other brother's name.
Oh, Jesus, Mitch. This is from Melissa Wallace. The Preds' Jack Hillen is nicknamed Jack. That is past lazy, if you ask me. I would agree. We'll have much more of these coming up. While Merrick is looking up crap, let's hit the intro music, shall we, and start the show.
Vest Pocket Rocket. Come on, that's gold.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
This is Tiger, and China law, if you kill Tiger like this, death penalty.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Sedin is not English for punch me or headlock me in a scrum.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Claude Richard, Vest Pocket Rocket. Yep. Went to Montreal training camp in 1959. Yeah. With the Habs, who was too slow to play in the NHL, even during the... I'm about to infuriate the French here. Even during the wartime where Maurice Richard dined out and earned his reputation. Ah, he's just a wartime hockey player. He'll never amount to anything.
Sounds like the naming of the Richard brothers was like what a fraternity back in the 1960s was. Your alpha beta name is Vest Pocket Rocket.
Oh, what? Yeah, Vest Pocket.
Oh. Hey, by the way, I don't think that you could really infuriate the French any more, sir, than they've already been infuriated by the naming of unilateral unilinguistic anglophone. Yeah. Yeah, Randy Cunnyworth as the head coach, the interim head coach of the Montreal Canadiens, replacing Jacques Martin, who of course was canned over the weekend.
There's a great moment in Slapshot when Denis Lemieux at the beginning of the Yvon Barrett, God bless him, playing Denis Lemieux at the beginning of the movie Slapshot says when he's being asked about penalties and how you shouldn't take penalties like slashing and ice stick and ooking, he says, "No, you never do that, never, never. Just some stupid English pig with no brain." And when I saw that headline for poor Randy Cunningworth, I went right back to Denis Lemieux, the stupid English pig with no brain. Now coach the abs.
What I found interesting about this is that the dude's an interim coach. Like, the first inclination from the French media isn't to say, "Oh, they're obviously waiting to find someone French to hire." It's "How dare you hire someone who is not French?" Honestly, dude, like, what are the other candidates out there at this moment if you need to fire Jacques Martin, like, millisecond away from that declaration, you gotta fire him? Who are you hiring?
Other than your AHL coach. Benoit Groulx is out there. Patrick Waugh's name is out there. Michel Therrien's name is out there.
These are guys that you're going to hire, replacement.
Clément Jodoin is the coach of the Hamilton Bulldogs, the American Hockey League, but they ain't doing that. I mean, Guy Boucher is probably the guy that most Habs fans would say, "Well, we should have had him," because the same language issue that confronts Randy Cunningworth would have confronted Kirk Muller, right?
Totally.
So let's be on the same. That would have been the exact same issue. I think that at the end of the season, and this is just, I'm going to throw a theory here and just throw it out there so we have it. if the Vancouver Canucks don't win the Stanley Cup this year, don't be surprised if Alain Vigneault is the Montreal Canadiens coach.
Wow.
They can't talk to him because that's obviously tampering. But as I'm just sort of piecing this all together and knowing that Cunningworth is there on an interim basis, and you look at the landscape, and I don't think that Patrick Roy, because he's very sensitive to the situations that he puts himself in, and if you think it was a disaster in Colorado and a potential mess, then look what you could be walking into in Montreal right now, where now the specter of language has once again reared its ugly head in the debate on who should coach the Montreal Canadiens. And he's very sensitive about where he puts himself, and he doesn't put himself in a situation where he can't win immediately. I don't know that Patrick Roy goes there, specifically not when there's a chance that Quebec City may have a team as early as next season. I think that's a much more palatable position for someone like Patrick Roy.
I would agree with that second point. I wonder if also the last smoking embers of his fiery passion to become a Habs coach were snuffed out the way that Dale Hunter's met the world in Washington, D.C., and the difficulty of that transition.
That is a great point, because I don't think you really even need to look just at Dale Hunter, but you look at coaches that have had fantastic success at the junior level, and Dale Hunter is the most obvious one, powerhouse London Knights, Memorial Cup winner 2005, struggling with the Washington Capitals with all that talent on that squad. Before him, it was Peter DeBoer, the Kitchener Rangers and Plymouth Whalers. Before that, the powerhouses of the OHL. Peter DeBoer led them to victory. You know, won the Memorial Cup with the Kitchener Rangers. To the Florida Panthers, struggle, and has been a challenge, although there's been times where it's looked like it's come together for the New Jersey Devils, but the transition hasn't been seamless. Patrick Roy's not stupid. He can read the landscape, and it's a lot different, you know, yelling and screaming and bullying kids into doing what you want than doing the same with players that have multi-million dollar and multi-year contracts in their hip pocket. That goes back to my previous point. Patrick is very sensitive about the situations that he puts him in. He will not parachute himself into a situation that is bad for Patrick Roy.
In fairness, his son was the one bullying kids most of the time. I would ask you, sir.
He's a musician now.
That's right. He's a rap star.
He is, man. It's awesome.
I know that. It's cool. I know. He's Joe DaKing. Do you think that Patrick Roy would rather be a GM or a coach? Because I think a guy like him, right, you look around the league, you see a lot of guys that you played with, a lot of your peers, they ain't coaching, man. They're up in the press box wearing a suit and watching the game and being the overlord of the franchise versus being the guy behind the bench. And I wonder what's more palatable to Patrick Roy.
I'll tell you what's more palatable to Patrick Roy. I know the answer exactly. Both. And that just doesn't happen in the National Hockey League.
right?
Like, that is what I'm assuming.
He wants to be Mike Keenan?
He wants to have it all. He wants to be the general manager, and he would like to be the coach. That's not going to happen. Like, just aren't enough hours in the day given the new demands that are on a general manager. Unless you have a very sophisticated capologist and a director of player personnel who does a lot of the heavy lifting. It's tough being a GM and a coach. We're going to talk to Jason Ferris a little bit later on, who wrote this great book called Behind the Moves. And once upon a time, you could do that, but you know, your time was really split. But given how complex not just the GM position, but also the coaching position is in the NHL right now, it's impossible to do that. But what does Patrick Roy want? I would assume both, Greg, both.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, it's impossible for a guy like Patrick Roy to get that gig. He simply, no team will give him that gig coming out of junior.
No.
Aren't there maybe like five coaches in the league that could get that gig though today?
I don't think there's any team president that would. I don't think there's any team president that would want all that power concentrated in one person.
If you're okay, let's say you're the worst team in hockey and you play in Columbus, and Mike Babcock said, you know what? I've proven everything I need to prove here in Detroit. I'm looking for a new gig. And the president of the Blue Jackets says, what do you need? And Babcock says, well, I've always fancied myself a general manager along with being a coach. What would they say to that?
I'll tell you can go from Scotty Bowman to Lou Nanny pretty fast in that scenario. I would still have to think that the answer is no, that those positions are split and those positions are distinct. Yeah, I can't see it happening. I think the days of coach and general manager have gone the way of the dodo bird. I can't see it ever happen. I would be shocked, Greg. My jaw would hit the ground to see that someone have a dual portfolio like that. Plus, it's always easier to fire one guy. And if you fire one guy, you remove two positions. Then you have to make two hires. Like, if you're the team president of the Columbus Blue, like, if, you know, if you're Mike Priest, president of the Columbus Blue Jackets, you say to yourself, they'll want to concentrate all that power in one person. And then, if I don't like the job that he's doing behind the bench, but I like his front office acumen, what do we do then? Am I just firing him as a head coach? What does that do to relationships? What does that do to politics? And if I fire him in both positions, because you always look for the exit strategy, you never hire someone without thinking how you're going to say goodbye to him, because that's the nature of the position. What happens then? Then you have to all of a sudden at one shot make two hires. That's tough, bro.
Jonathan Dunphy wants us to know, wants to know why we haven't talked about the one guy in the league that obviously can be a GM and a coach. Errol, Zach Parise will be a New Jersey Devil for the rest of his life.
Yeah,
I will force the Kool-Aid down his gullet. He will be a Devil. I promise you that.
I wonder, you're closer to it than I am. I wonder how much influence Lou Lamoriello still has over things like, you know, drills and practice and day-to-day stuff. And listen, Marty still holds a lot of sway on that team. He's, you know, he's, whether he's not in the pocket, he's at least in the vest pocket of Lou Lamoriello. There you go, your Richard metaphor. I still wonder how much influence Lou Lamoriello does have over day-to-day operations of the Devils.
Oh, I don't think it's like he's sitting up in the stands during practice going, "Era, I only saw 50 jumping jacks.
move that pylon left. I don't want that pylon there."
"Errol, about time for a bag skate, isn't it, DeBoer?
I think you've had enough of that water, haven't you? Back on the ice."
That's right. That's right, because he's so frugal. "Errol, the stick's broken. Tape it up. You don't need a new one." Oh, jeez. Hey, so as you know, I'm a Devils fan, which means I'm American, which means that I obviously can't comment on things like the Winnipeg Jets. I learned that the hard way this weekend, Merrick.
Hey, what happened between you and the Jets this week? That was insanity. I went back and read some. Holy smokes, did they hit you, whack you like a pinata? You were the Jersey pinata.
Where it began was... in Jersey Fouls last week, we ran a Jersey Foul of a Solani jersey that's on a new Winnipeg Jets jersey.
Yeah,
you know, the
like
one
that.
With the
like
military propaganda logo on the front. So they put the Solani name and number on the back, and I found that to be blasphemous. I mean, it made me murdery is, I think, the word that I use, because
that's a little strong.
I have a real problem with the blurring of lines between a franchise that still exists in the National Hockey League, which is Winnipeg Jets 1.0 and Winnipeg Jets 2.0. And I find it really, the Timo Solani homecoming this weekend really was sort of like a point of contention for me. I think the vast majority of Winnipeg fans treated it correctly, which is a conquering hero returning to Winnipeg, and we are celebrating this moment for Winnipeg hockey. I
Correct.
Think there is a select number of these fans that are delusional and that see Timo Solani somehow tangentially involved with the new franchise, much like naming the team the Jets kind of nudges it close to their history and nudges it close to the record book and nudges it close to all of the history that they had as a franchise in an attempt to try to reclaim a legacy that, again, and this is my problem with it, is recognized by another team in this league. The Phoenix Coyotes recognize their past as the Winnipeg Jets. Until that's no longer the case, or until that franchise folds, then I think it's fair to say that the Coyotes have a right to celebrate that legacy more than Winnipeg Jets 2.0, who are, of course, the converted Atlanta Thrashers. You have made the example before, sir, of a dude dating a woman with the same name.
Well, here's this.
And
okay,
trying to act like the relationship never ended.
Well, here's this. Okay, Greg Wyshynski is dating Susan, and Susan dumps Greg Wyshynski. Wah, wah, wah. Sad trombone. Years later, he pulls himself together. He can finally get out of the house. He's no longer Brian Wilson. He finds another girl. Her name just happens to be Susan. Greg Wyshynski decides to put a blonde wig on her to make her look like Susan 1.0 and pretend that she is indeed Susan 1.0. I think at that point we're allowed to say, "Greg, I'm a friend of yours, dude. We need to talk. You know, you can't do this. You're behaving ridiculously."
It's the delusion of it all that bothers me. It's like, you know, if you went around that arena on Saturday and said, how many of you would retire Solani's number and hang it from the rafters of the MTS Center? How many do you think would?
I think a lot of them would.
Exactly. And that's delusional.
I think that's another franchise's player.
But you know what, played for this team.
But that is, to your point earlier, I blame fans because they put the pressure on Mark Chipman, and Chipman didn't want to call this team the Jets. But that's what happens when you blur things and you call something the Winnipeg Jets, and they are not. the Winnipeg Jets. That team is in Phoenix. But when you make things as gray and murky as it is now by calling, listen, he wanted to call them, was it the Polar Bears or something else, called them the Manitoba Moose, called something else other than the Jets. That's what happens when you blur the lines. And to a casual hockey fan, like, this is, man, Greg, this is like, and that's what I love about this podcast and everyone who tweets us and emails us and now hits us up on Facebook on our page. Like, this is like hockey nerd talk, man. This is like hockey geek talk. We think about these, like, these things are important to us. To a casual fan who just plunks down his or her $80, $90, $100, $200, for tickets, they don't think about things like this. All they know is Teemu Selanne was here and then he wasn't and now he's come back and I miss him and I'd love to look up one day and see his number up there and go, yeah, I remember when he scored 76. I don't think they think about it as deeply as we do.
Listen, man, and if you want to feel that way, that's fine. But there are rules for these things. There's decorum for these things. And I believe that, you know, when you, here's the example that was given to me as a point of defense was this. The Ottawa Senators have number 8 retired for Frank Finnegan, who played for the Ottawa Senators from 1923 through 1934. Okay, that franchise doesn't exist anymore. That franchise moved to St. Louis. It folded in 1935. My point is, as long as you have a team in the National Hockey League that recognizes its legacy as the Winnipeg Jets, I don't think it's fair for the current team to try to co-opt that legacy as their own, to share that history.
I'm with you.
And that's my basic problem with it. And Winnipeg fans torched me for it. They, you know, hey, how dare an American say that sort of thing? Stupid American analysis. I don't give a shit. I really don't. If you don't think I have a dog in this fight, that's fine. It doesn't mean I'm not right, because I am right.
You know what? You mentioned Frank Finnegan, and he had one of the great nicknames of all time, the Shawville Express. And at this time, when we should be thinking about friends and thinking about family and thinking about Christmas, let's not forget that the Shawville Express actually died on Christmas Day in 1991.
Yeesh.
He had a heart attack like a week before and died on Christmas Day. So there's a nice little bow and present there to wrap up this nifty little conversation.
The last two things I want to say about this is, first off, I really believe in my heart of hearts, after dealing with my new friends in Winnipeg all weekend, and God bless you all, you're very dedicated. Although you need to work on your smack talk, you're far too polite. I think
they haven't been in the game for a while. They've been doing AHL smack talk.
Right.
They're gonna graduate to the NHL soon, bro. Don't worry.
Once they get back to the Norris, it'll be all fine. There'll be a lot of anger and vitriol. My one problem with the whole thing is, I really do feel like there's lingering disappointment because they came so close to having the Coyotes move back to Winnipeg, that it almost feels like they are using this new franchise as a way to reclaim what they almost reclaimed. If the Coyotes are in Winnipeg now and they're the Jets, case closed. Who gives a shit? Retire all the old Jets numbers you want. Essence, all of them. Who cares?
Jimmy Mann!
Stu
Jim
Barnes.
Kite! All of them.
I think there's some lingering resentment that they came so close to reclaiming that legacy, and now they've just decided to do it anyway, even though they didn't get the team. The second thing is this, and this is, again, my own opinion, my own feeling on this matter. It's just how I live my life as a fan. If the Devils moved away tomorrow to Seattle, and it could happen. I mean, Jesus, they're broke. And then another team came to New Jersey in 15 years, and they decided to call themselves the Devils, and they had a really kick-ass black jersey because they needed to market the thing, you know, in a more effective way than the Devils do now. And they decided to call themselves the Devils. I would not recognize this team as the Devils. I would not in any way, shape, or form say Patrick Elias is the leading scorer in franchise history. I would not expect to see Brodeur's name and number hang in that arena. It's a different team. It's a different – the page is turned. And so that's just kind of how I feel. If I put myself in the shoes of a Jets fan, that's how I feel about the situation. I know I'm not alone. I know that there are plenty of people in Winnipeg who do kind of frown upon the folks that are blurring the lines right now. But I know there's a lot, and I think I heard from all of them over the weekend, that also think that – honoring the traditions, quote-unquote traditions, of the old team is not necessarily believing that Jets 2.0 are, in fact, Jets 1.0.
So wait a minute. You're telling me that the Seattle team won't be called the Metropolitans? Because they have to be called the Metropolitans, man. How can they not be called the Metropolitans?
I would hope they would.
Let's go back to the PCHA.
No, I would hope that they
Come
would
on.
Go. I would hope they call them the Seattle Mudhoney. Or something grungy like that. I mean, the grunge gave us so many solid names that we can go with.
The grunge, honey. I was going to go with
the Seattle Bikini Kill.
Or do you go even more? Oh, that's good too. Do you go back to the Seattle Plaid? That's one. Do you go to like, the Spanish flu, you know, the influenza epidemic in 1919 that wiped out the Stanley Cup finals? Do you go back that dark in history? the Seattle flu.
No. No. That's terrible.
Well, you got the Philly flu.
Yeah, you got, and evidently you also have the Boston flu tonight based on what's happening.
Holy smokes! Who was that? What does Lucic get by the way?
Real quick here, let's touch on this Lucic thing before we,
let's do that.
Hop on.
We got our guests coming up here.
Milan Lucic, Rene Bork, Eric Cole all had little incidents over the weekend. Here's what happened with Lucic and his explanation of the matter, in a hit on Zach Ronaldo.
I realized he was in a bit of a vulnerable position, and you know, I looked and watched the tape again in slow mo, and looked at the point of contact, and it was his shoulder more than anything, and you can see him turning this way when he's going into the boards, a call was, it is what it is, just glad no one got hurt in the play and that we won here tonight.
One game.
First off, being in a vulnerable position, I believe, being in a vulnerable position for Lucic means being on the ice with me, is I think what he means by being in a vulnerable position.
You think
he
got a game,
huh?
He got a game. He did. It's official.
Oh, he did get a game. Okay.
Yeah, he got one game. He got one game. See, I have a hard time, because I can't distinguish. Help me here, folks. On Twitter, at Jeff Merrick. On Twitter, at Wyszynski. Help us here. What is the difference between the Lucic hit on Ronaldo versus the Rene Bork hit last night on Seabrook versus the Dion Phaneuf hit on Zach Cassian from Saturday? Now, that didn't even get a whisper, right, the Dion Phaneuf hit. But isn't that kind of identical to the hit on Zach Ronaldo? Player wasn't hurt. Pop right. Zach Ronaldo went and got in a fight. He went and fought Nathan. Yeah. And then yesterday said, the hit was fine, shoulder to shoulder.
It's really difficult.
I don't know what is, man. I know
the NHL weighs,
but man.
When the NHL weighs injuries so much within their disciplinary process, and you see a guy skate away from a hit and get into a fight, it's almost like you've invalidated your opportunity to get a suspension out of this. If you get up from a hit and you turn and fight somebody, it's almost like, all right, you've cashed your chip in here, sir.
Yep.
But one game,
there'll be no suspension. I think this is, do you think this is a Ryan Miller suspension?
I think it's a go sit in the corner suspension, yeah, for sure.
I think this is a suspension to get him on the books as being a repeat offender. I think it wasn't big enough to throw something. I thought, if anything, he would get a fine just so they could have him on the books as being a repeat offender. Like, this is sort of,
I think,
because he does walk that line more so than probably anyone else in the National Hockey League. Right? So this is, and I think this still might be fumes of not suspending him from Ryan Miller. I think what this does is this puts him on the clock right now for Brendan Shannon.
Interesting. So you think this is like the first red card, right?
I think it is.
In preparation for this. Hey, I don't think, I actually think that's a really great theory. And I've said this to Shanahan. I think sometimes these things get political. He's denied it, but I think they do. But the politics only go so far. And for those who might be out there saying, well, on top of being a suspension for Lucic, that's sort of like a wake-up call and a ding on his record, it's also a chance for the NHL to say, hey, look, we can punish Bruins. We're not biased. We can punish Bruins.
Really?
How many people out there have said that a player hasn't gotten a suspension, be it Lucic or someone else, because they're Bruins?
Yes.
Gone on and on.
Well, no, Lucic got suspended in the playoffs. The cross-check to the face of Maxim Lapierre got him a game. No one's taken the big, you know, no one's taken a 15-gamer, or no one's taken a 5-gamer, or an 8-gamer, or what was it called, a Wisniewski. No one's taken a Wisniewski yet for the Boston Bruins. But has there really been anything? And I can hear the Montreal Canadiens fans already hurling things at their computers here. I haven't seen anything the Boston Bruins have done in the past couple of years that would warrant anything like a 5 or a 10-game review. What did Danny Pyatt get for the race? What did Danny Pyatt get for the Sawada hit? Was it 3?
Hang on. I think it
what
was.
What did he get for that? Was that the most?
Might have been. But again, that's a foot soldier. That ain't a general. You know what I mean? And I think the problem that a lot of fans have had is that the guy. Yeah, Chara, Lucic have always been guys that get away with this shit, and other guys get dinged for it. So, I mean, again, I don't think it goes that deep politically, but I think that, I think Merrick's right in the sense that they suspended him just to get him on the record now. And now, keep him honest.
Does Rene Bork get something? Does he get a game too?
This is the real, This is the real tricky one, man. If you watch that play, and again, what happened was Seabrook got hit from behind, his head driven into the glass. He looked like he was on Neptune after that hit, and it didn't look like a good scene. And he's had a concussion history, but he is traveling with the team to Pittsburgh, so maybe a good sign there. What happened though is like Seabrook lost the puck. There was Stéphane Auger, the referee, in between Seabrook and Bork. And then Bork hit him as sort of Seabrook's going back trying to collect. It was a very awkward play as far as body positioning. But there ain't no question that Bork finished him off with a shove into the boards. And the shove is what drove Seabrook's head and neck into the glass.
If you look at what Rene Bork, like if you look at body position, Rene Bork's right shoulder, and this is a classic move, like this is a textbook body check, but we got to take into consideration all this happens at top speed. Rene Bork, watch his right shoulder, it was targeting for Brent Seabrook's left shoulder, because that's what you do on the wall. You want to close it off. So his right shoulder is committed to that left shoulder, but when the puck gets caught in Stéphane Auger's skates a little bit, Seabrook kind of turns a little bit to collect it out of the referee's skates. I don't know if you should. I don't know. Game officials like the referees to be right in the corner. Others like them out and a little more active. I'm not sure who the supervisor was for the game, but whoever it was is obviously one of the supervisors that says, I want the refs in the corner, and you go and you hide there, regardless of what's happening in front of the net. So Auger gets in the way. Seabrook goes behind him to try to grab it, and so instead of hitting him on the shoulder, he was lining up for a textbook. Like, this is what you learn when you body check. A textbook body check turned into, you know, Brent Seabrook with his eyes crossed and seeing Tweety Birds.
But he shoved them at the end. He shoved them into the glass, though. Come on.
It's so fast. Like, once you're committed to that hit at that distance,
hey, dude,
man,
I think it deserves a good discussion as far as whether that's a suspension or not, because it looked terrible, but there were kind of some mitigating circumstances. The one that baffles me, though, dude, I ain't saying this as a Devils fan. I'm saying this as a guy with two functioning eyes, is Eric Cole hitting Adam Larson in the head behind the net and getting nothing. He got nothing.
I know, I saw that. The first time I saw it, I said, oh, man, someone just took a 10-gamer. It just got worse for the Habs. And
I mean, was that just no injury? I mean, was it that way?
I think the mitigating factor is, again, a player who's reaching for the puck and drops his head. I think this is closer to Ryan Malone, Chris Campoli than anything, even though the placement on the ice is different because Campoli was coming up the ice out of his own zone, reaching for the puck with his head down, versus Adam Larson, who's coming around the net, and it's that juicy, low-hanging fruit right there that Steve Downey caught Dean McCammond and Rafi Torres caught Jason Williams. It's that dangerous area right there. And to make it worse, Larson dips down and reaches for the puck, and at the last minute, his head sort of drops down a couple of feet, putting him right in shoulders distance for Eric Cole. I guess that was the mitigating factor, but when it happened so fast, the first time I saw it, Greg, oh man, that's a 10-gamer for sure. That's what I thought.
Elena, let's isolate juicy low-hanging fruit.
DJ,
you know,
when are we gonna find a DJ? When are we gonna find a DJ to loop all of our gold?
I'm sure we have a DJ in the audience. Listen, if I could find people in my audience to tell me the inside story of Poop Glove, I think we could probably find a DJ that can cut together a techno mix of all of our sexual double entendres. Real quick, two tweets. Yep. Up the pucks. If Seattle named their team the Bikini Kill, we would have to seriously reconsider our hockey allegiances. Hey, there you go. Marketing, baby. And then Chaos of 99 writes in about Lucic. The suspension is probably a result of him admitting that he hit a guy he thought was in a vulnerable position. It's being a surgeon and admitting to having botched an operation. It's asking to get sued or suspended. That's a very good point. I mean, he did kind of acknowledge the fact that he was cognizant of the guy being in a vulnerable spot. Once you do that, I guess it's a real aha moment when it comes to supplemental discipline.
I'm trying to think of who it was. There was a defenseman on the Calgary Flames yesterday after the Rene Bork hit, who was talking to Roger Millions. Was it TJ Brody? No, it wasn't Brody. Anyway, I can't remember who it was. Might have been Chris Butler. And he said to Roger, because Roger asked him about the hit, and he said, yeah, I guess, you know, Rene kind of caught him in a vulnerable position. He shouldn't have done that, or something to that effect. And the minute that I was working with John Shannon and Brad May, the minute we heard a Calgary Flames player said, yeah, he caught him in a vulnerable position, we thought, uh-oh, that's the last thing you want to be saying. That is the, yeah, my guy did something bad. Just say, hey, I was just finishing my check. I wasn't aware that he had put himself in a vulnerable position. Things happened quickly out there, and I didn't see him turn his numbers to the boards. That's all you had to say. But the minute, I think, you know, the who is it that tweeted us that one? That's a really good point. That was Stefan, Chaos of 99. Yeah, said, sure. The minute you submit to having a player in a vulnerable position and you don't pull up, that's like saying, put the cuffs
like,
on me.
It's like you said last week. It's the reason the NHL doesn't call it an epidemic.
Legal. Don't call it an epidemic, because if you do, you better stop the season. Hey, we have our guest on the line. I know I've been talking about this book from pretty much day one of this podcast, and for good reason. This is one of the finest hockey books I may have ever read. Like, this is, I know, Greg, you're a big, you know, Ken Dryden, the game guy, and that's totally an influential book and an important book. The thing that's interesting about Behind the Moves, NHL General Managers Tell How Winners Are Built, I'm sitting here in my office, and I'm just doing this is like a little unscientific survey, and I'm looking around. There's a lot of books about players. There's a lot of books about hockey decades. There's a lot of books about dynasties. There's a lot of books about coaches. There's a lot of books about referees. But on a quick scan of my library, and Greg, I suspect yours is the same, and anyone who's listening is exactly the same, good luck finding one about general managers and what general managers think about hockey and how to construct hockey teams. Well, Jason Ferris has done that. The book is called Behind the Moves, NHL General Managers Tell How Winners Are Built. I couldn't give it a higher recommendation. Jason Ferris joins us. Jason, how are you today, bud?
I'm great. Thanks for being number one on the fan club.
Well, listen, I've been banging the drum for a while, and you know what? It's not as if I paid the media price for this book too. Which is free 99. I actually plunked down my own dough for this one when I first found out that it was available, knowing your work from previous, specifically the Cesar Maniego book. This book, I keep telling everyone, if you're gonna get a Christmas book, go out and get it. I got the professional edition with the big posters and the list of general managers.
Oh, fan Greg, club indeed.
Dude, this is awesome, man.
Did you get the Blu-ray too? Oof.
I wish there was a Blu-ray that came with it. I'm just like, this to me is like, I'm just like a kid on Christmas when this finally showed up and I cracked into it and broke the spine and just started tearing into it. I'm curious though, Jason, why do you think that there have never been books in a serious way ever written about how general managers put together hockey teams?
I think the answer is pretty easy. I think there's no access. That's the trick about trying to get general manager, like inside information about general managers. They're incredibly guarded and for good reason. So I think, you know, for somebody like me, who isn't, in the mainstream hockey writing world, and I'm not a columnist. There's not a huge threat from me. I come out of the business and the executive world myself. So I was really able to establish long-term relationships with the prominent GMs and over time have leadership conversations with them. They're all hockey-based conversations, but leadership conversations with them where I think they knew that they were going to be able to communicate in a long form their perspective around building teams rather than just be grilled about, you know, the last stupid call-up they made from the minors or the, you know, the recent headshot by one of their players. So I think that access was really key. And, you know, there's every living general manager who has taken a team to the Stanley Cup final was actively involved in this making of this book, with one exception, and that is Mike Keenan, which probably won't surprise fans. But everyone else, from Lamoriello to Sather to Burke to, you know, Ray Shiro to Stan Bowman to guys like Bill Torrey and Emil Francis, all of them were really heavily involved, provided memorabilia, stories. We did over 120 hours of interviews with all of these guys, plus spent just countless time with them. So I think it's a pretty unique look. And as a result, it's a book that's not available in stores. So, Jeff, you know, you went online and found it. That's really the only way people can get it. But it is a pretty unique project in not only the scope, but like you say, it comes with, there's a 48-page statistics guide on NHL general managers. There's a large timeline wall chart showing all the GMs back to the 1920s and then a big poster sort of showing what we call their genealogy and how they're all connected. So it's a pretty unique project and one that people have to go to www.nhlgms.com to find out about.
I would have paid good money if you had sat down with Brian Burke for the first time and just looked him in the eye and said, hey, Komisarek for Stamkos, what do you think? Just to get a reaction. Hey, listen, one of the things I've always been fascinated about when it comes to general managers, specifically in hockey, is you do have some eggheads, you do have some brainiacs, but for the most part, you've got ex-jocks. And I was wondering about that aesthetic when it comes to their personalities. I mean, is it at the end of the day still athletes competing against each other, or is it more corporate? Is it more executive versus executive?
I think at the end of the day, the fundamental job of a GM is player evaluation and figuring out who can play and who can't. And if it's not the GM directly, then it's him building the hockey operations group that can figure that question out. So I think at that essence, that's what the GM fundamentally has to do. But you're right. I mean, there's no doubt it's a much more executive, operation these days. You know, 20, 30 years ago, it was the GM who was typically the GM coach and a secretary and a scout. And part of the purpose of this book is to sort of chart the evolution of the sophistication of general management and how the staffs have just exploded into these traveling entourages of hockey operations people. But it's interesting. Many of the GMs are former players, but those guys are unique in the sense that one common thread I discovered with the GMs that were players is almost all of them at one point in time negotiated their own contract as a player. And if you think about guys in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that was really unheard of, to do that on your own. So I think many of the GMs today who were players are guys who exhibited a real interest in the game and also, I think, a backbone and a strength to them to say, look, I want to take charge of my own career and understand, the ins and outs of the game. So these guys are very thoughtful GMs. Guys like a Serge Savard, for instance, I mean, he was a player, but a good businessman and somebody that really understood what it took to build a team and used the lessons he learned as a player in formulating the Canadiens, and everything from how he structured his contracts and the bonuses to how he recruited players was based on what he learned growing up as a player.
You know, we talked a couple of moments ago here on the podcast, Jason, about the way that the dual portfolio of coach and general manager has gone the way of the dodo bird. I mean, I just went back actually this morning. I just cracked open the book one more time and landed on the Lou Nanny page, and he talked about being a player on Wednesday, and then by Saturday he was the coach, the general manager, the head CEO. That really has gone the way of yesterday, and I don't think we'll ever see again an era where you have that dual portfolio where the general manager is also the coach and he controls everything. Everything right now, is just like in life and in all careers, everything is so heavily specialized, and a general manager, even though some may bleed up into team president, it's very rare, if ever now, you'll see it bleed down to coach.
Yeah, you're right. And I think Brian Murray, I'm just going on memory, I think Brian Murray probably was the one that last held that kind of dual portfolio. But you would think of guys, going back in time for sure, like a Pat Quinn or, certainly a Glenn Sather, right? Or go back even further, Emile Francis. And, those kind of guys were, that was the center of the organization. And this is, I guess, I don't know if it's the dirty little secret, but it's sort of maybe an unfortunate thing, which is everybody would like to think of the GMs as this wonderful fraternity of guys that are, kibitzing among each other and wheeling and dealing and all this kind of stuff among them. Well, that was definitely the case 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago and more when, as I say, the staffs were so small. So, a guy like Pat Quinn in Vancouver and Cliff Fletcher, who might have been in Calgary or Toronto, and, name any other GM, they didn't have a big staff. So their fraternity and their colleagues were their fellow general managers, and so that room of general managers was really tight, and these guys had a lot of fun together. They goofed around, they pulled pranks, and there's a lot of great stories of pranks and kind of hijinks behind the scenes in the book, because that was their fraternity, those were their running buddies. Well, now you look at a guy like in Vancouver, Mike Gillis, he's got a couple of assistant general managers, he's got a capologist, he's got massage guys, he's got this and that, and those are his colleagues now. So the relationships between the GMs is not nearly as close. And John Ziegler, who was the former president of the league, really cultivated the GMs and gave the GMs a lot of power. The GM committee had a lot of power in the league, and right now it's been really quite neutered, and these guys don't spend a lot of time together. And so oftentimes deals will get done by the assistant GMs, and eventually the GM will bless it, but a lot of that interplay between the GMs isn't there. So it's not quite what it used to be, but still it's now a set of specialized skills that come together with the GM managing a network of people.
Jason Ferris, author of Behind the Moves with Merrick versus Wyshynski on a Monday. Hey, Jason, so Merrick read your book. I typically only read coloring books so I've not read it yet.
Well, you know, let me stop you there, because for fans, you know, this isn't a read where, you know, it's 252 pages. It's a huge book. It's not a book where you sit down and read page 1 to 252. It's really, there's a lot of imagery and art history and, you know, old artifacts and contracts. And so there's fun little things to discover. And then
yeah, you said,
really,
you said coffee table book kind of situation.
Yeah, and it's the words of the GMs. It's not me pontificating on general manager. It's the raw words of the GM telling his philosophy and the other GMs really weighing in on what it was like to do deals with that guy. So you really
sounds
get
like
the 360 degree view.
I love it. I love it. Hey, so to that end though, and I say this without really knowing the content of the book all that well, do you have the juicy trades that almost happened in this book? And is there one in particular that you feel is the juiciest?
Well, there's lots of either, you know, GMs that were left at the altar, you know, hoping to have done a deal that didn't get done. Probably one of the best deals that never got done was, you know, you guys talked about Stamkos. I mean, there was an ownership group in Tampa Bay not too long ago that was kind of, you know, controlling things, and I guess Brian Lawton, I think, was the GM at the time, and you know, Glenn Sather basically had a deal for Stamkos done, which would have been an unbelievably ridiculous deal in favor of the Rangers, and it was all because, you know, ownership was you know, thinking that they were running the hockey club. So that was a deal that was done in Europe, and unfortunately, I guess cooler heads in Tampa prevailed when they got back stateside and nixed the deal. But you know, there's a lot of those types of things where you get a wily guy like a Sather who definitely can you know, go a long way to stealing a player, and he almost did in Stamkos.
That's interesting, because even before that, when Rick Dudley was running the Tampa Bay Lightning, they almost traded Vincent LeCavalier to Toronto. Cabrelet, Antropov, I think Modine was in that package. Either Brad Boyes or Cash was the other bit of compensation. So they dodged two bullets there with Stamkos and then Vincent LeCavalier previous to that. Do you have, for me, it's always been Bill Torrey. Like the idea, you know, there's a general manager's award now in the National Hockey League. There's no actual trophy for it. It hasn't been named. But to me, the ultimate general manager has to be Bill Torrey. No disrespect to Sam Pollock or anyone else thinks is an elite-level heavyweight in that position. But Bill Torrey, you know, Sam Pollock walked into something. You know, he was already, you know, not that he didn't build anything himself, but he walked into a structure that was already built for him. Bill Torrey did the Islanders from scratch. Like, sure, he had a background with the Cleveland Seals, the Oakland Seals, but I mean, he really built the New York Islanders from nothing, from zero to four Stanley Cups. To me, Bill Torrey is the greatest general manager that I ever saw. Who do you think is?
Yeah, I think Bill Torrey's a pretty darn good choice. He's a fascinating guy because he actually came out of the Ice Capades and Harlem Globetrotters world back in the 60s and, you know, had part of the franchise there. So he knew all about ice shows and the entertainment side of things, and then was intimately involved in the Pittsburgh Hornets AHL hockey club before going to the farce that was the California Seals. But he learned a lot, and he charts a lot of the great expansion stories. I mean, just behind the scenes stuff that you just would never believe happened in California. So there's some fun things there. But when he got to Long Island, you know, a couple things happened. First of all, he thought his ownership group had a lot more money than they did. And so things quickly changed on him, like it did for many NHL expansion teams in the early 70s. But he also really knew how to manage his owners. And he counseled them very closely that, look, this expansion draft is going to give us absolutely nothing. So, and that coupled with the fact that his crosstown rivals, the Rangers, were at their peak. You know, he said, look, we're not going to compete for fans in the first few years. We're going to have a bad team. There's no point blowing our brains out. So let's go slow and really build this thing the right way. And they waited year after year for their first round pick, and they made good on those picks, hung with them, and then, you know, 5 years later began to really have a team. But I think, you know, that not all GMs have the foresight to manage their owners that way, to manage expectations. Yeah. And so that was a big part of what he did. And then, of course, you know, the Goring trade is very much, you know, considered a key deal that helped put him over the top. And, and obviously, you know, picking a guy like Al Arbor and sticking with him when they were, you know, chanting from the rafters, fire Al Arbor after the playoff exit. So he's done a lot of very good things there. And he's a wry guy with a great sense of humor. And there's some great negotiation stories with him and players like Pat Flatley and Mike Bossy and whatnot. So people that want to see sort of the insides of how deals got done, there's some great stuff from Bill Torrey.
And a nice little part of the book, too, when you show a picture of Bill Torrey actually holding a pencil. And when you walked into Bill Torrey's office and he was negotiating your contract, he would hold a pencil. But if you walked into his office and he was holding a pen, that meant that he wasn't negotiating. He was done, and whatever he wrote down, that was going to be the number. Stories like that and other stories you can find in Behind the Moves, NHL General Managers Tell How Winners Are Built. Our guest has been Jason Ferris. Jason, congratulations on the book. Really quick, where can people find it again?
They can get it at NHLGMs.com, and it also ships. There's 12 different limited editions, so there is a Bill Torrey edition that's hand-signed and hand-numbered by Bill Torrey. And
what?
So there's one. Yeah, absolutely. And there's one for, you know, Neil Smith in New York, and Brian Burks is signed in Toronto, and Jimmy Devolano and Kenny Holland
wow.
in Detroit.
Jason, so, Jason, yeah. Is there a Mike Milbury edition I can buy?
No, he didn't make the cut. There's some good Milbury stories in there, how he screwed
oh, yeah.
Burke on a deal.
I'm sure there's a lot of good ones. Any of them at a youth rink in Boston?
No.
Yeah. There's a Legends edition that's signed by Sather, Harry Sinden, Emil Francis, and Bill Torrey, which is, that one's almost sold out, actually. But if people order it, you know, and if they hear and they order, you know, using the express shipping option, it'll still get there for Christmas for them. And if not, it'll be a great present for them after Christmas.
Outstanding. Jason, thanks for joining us today. Best of luck with the book. We'll catch up soon.
Great. Thanks for your support, guys.
Thanks, man.
Anytime. Jason Ferris.
Hey,
you know,
so Merrick, is it?
Yeah.
Merrick, is the book structured like the old, like the SNL book that came out like a couple years ago, where it's just, it's like the GMs in their own words, and there's just a little bit of setup in between the block quotes, that kind of thing?
The way that it works, and there's a really nice, there's a really interesting foreword, actually. It's written by Brian Burke, and then there's a piece that's written by John Ziegler as well, who does this really nice, and I've never heard Ziegler talk about this era before, where he talks about the WHA and how it impacted the National Hockey League by teams losing players and having to bid for contracts. But he also brought up a great point, too, is that if it weren't for the WHA, the NHL, because the contracts weren't guaranteed until the WHA
right.
came into existence. Now the WHA essentially forced the National Hockey League to go the route of guaranteed contracts. Otherwise, players in the NHL could break their contracts with the NHL and jump to a rival league. The only way they can keep their players is to guarantee all the contracts. I mean, salary sky, and so Ziegler writes a really nice piece about that. Jason does some good writing as well. But then it is, like there's, let me just open the book here. I just opened a Tommy Ivan here. Okay, so there's a section on Tommy Ivan, and then there's a little bit of Tommy Ivan in his own words, and then there's Cliff Fletcher talking about Tommy Ivan. There's Lou Lamoriello talking about Tommy Ivan. There's Daryl Sutter talking about Tommy Ivan. Here's Emil Francis. Here's Scotty Bowman talking about Emil Francis. Nick Beverly talking about – like this is – like as far as a research project goes, I can't imagine
the amount
of time that Jason spent on this. Honestly, Wish, you are going to love this.
I can't wait to pick it up. I'm also impressed that he was able to locate John Ziegler. That wasn't always an easy thing when he was the commissioner.
Oh, boy. Well, you just had to hang out with Bill Wirtz.
Let's do some puck headlines.
Merrick versus Wyshynski. Puck headlines.
He went missing. Remember that?
Yeah.
In a playoff. I think it was like that. They just would go missing. Dateline National Hockey League. Your three stars for the past week. It was Ottawa Senators forward Jason Spezza as your number one star, Pekka Rene, your number two star, and Evgeny Malkin, your number three star of the past week.
5 points against the Buffalo Sabres, got his groove back. Yo, look at Evgeny Malkin. You know what's impressed me about Jason Spezza more than anything else? This year has been the first year that Jason Spezza really hasn't been surrounded by a lot of veterans. I mean, he's always been able to, even though he's, you know, been an elite-level player with a high skill set, some say, he's still a turnover machine, whatever. This is the first year that Jason Spezza has to, in a lot of ways, be a shepherd. Because he's playing with a lot of kids. Alfredson's in another lineup with various injuries. This is the year that Jason Spezza has to be the mature Jason Spezza. He can't be the same guy that's along for the ride, that's just a superstar player with a big skill set. He has to help the Eric Condras and the Colin Greenings and the Bobby Butler. This has been like a real maturing year for Jason Spezza. He's not going to put up the century note as far as points go anymore in his career, I don't think. But he's turning into a more, like, he still turns the puck over at bad times. That's always going to be the knock on Jason Spezza.
Right.
But he's a lot more mature, I think, than we've ever seen him.
And he'll be an all-star. Paranoid Puck reports that the NHL Network is getting a major overhaul, including NHL On the Fly being changed to NHL Tonight, with a bit of a little format tweak there. Also, expect more, shall we say, ESPN classic-y, maybe? I don't know. Like top 10 shows, like countdown shows, that kind of thing,
yeah.
Which is kind of a cool idea. So once again, John Collins putting his fingerprints all over the NHL Network and making it better. Dateline Columbus. Yeah. So Scott Howson doesn't blame the coach in Columbus, according to the Columbus Dispatch. Coaching is not an issue on this team as to where we are right now. The players have to take it upon themselves to play better. We're all struggling through this, players included. It is not easy. We have to, as a group, keep persevering and try to find the light at the end of the tunnel. Translation, it's way too late to fire the coach. Who gives a shit? We're done anyway.
Why? That's what I was going to say. I mean, the moment for firing the coach is past. I mean, the moment for firing the coach is probably when Ken Hitchcock went to St. Louis. And there's not a chance that this team is getting close to the playoffs. So it might as well. This sounds horrible for an NHL team. It's kind of like a lame duck season now. Now
totally.
This is the
totally.
this becomes fail for nail, right? This becomes, you know, fall for haul. This is now fail for nail to see who can grab Yakupov. Although Grigorenko is not going to be a pretty bad consolation
prize. I believe you mean stink for Grink is what you mean.
Oh, is that what it is? Stink
yeah,
for Grink?
Stink for Grink.
Who came up with that? That's brilliant.
I don't know. You're number one pick in the draft. You get number one pick in the draft. You get plenty of stink, though. Also, a couple of other park headlines. Mark Stahl almost cleared for contact with the New York Rangers. Claude Giroux back in workouts with the Flyers, which is great news for them,
yep.
considering what happened
yep.
with Pronger last week. And finally, one last puck headline. Oh, by the way, tourist trade. What were your thoughts on the tourist trade?
I think that Ottawa wins this one hands down. If you look down the middle of the Ottawa Senators now, it looks pretty fantastic, don't you think? Spezza, and then all of a sudden you slide in. You slide in Kyle Turris. You got Mika Zibanejad on
Sorry.
The horizon. Derek Smith, I mean,
Zach
Smith.
Playing games on paper, evidently.
I know, but I mean, you're playing games on paper with David Rundblad, whom
yeah,
I'm not a
well,
big... To me, Greg, I thought that Don Maloney would go out and try to get some established NHL guys because they need to win now. This idea that we can just trade for a future guy. I mean, to me, David Rundblad right now is an American Hockey League defenseman who needs time in the American Hockey League. That's just not what I think. Other people around the NHL said this guy belongs in the AHL. I thought Maloney would have tried to get a guy to help him get in the playoffs right now. Because this is a right now time for the Phoenix Coyotes. Who knows who's going to own it? Who knows where it's going to be? All I know is everyone in that organization is under immense amount of pressure to get into the playoffs. I'm shocked they did it for someone who really should be in the AHL and still have the prospect tag attached to him.
I'm not. I think it's a great trade for Phoenix. I love the fact they got a two out of the deal. And I love the fact that this kid's going to come up and he's going to play with Yandle. He's going to play with those guys and he's going to play under Tippett and he's going to learn a thing or two about defense and become a very, very good pro, I think. And Turris, hey, listen.
How quick is he in the AHL, Greg? How quick is he? And that's a demanding defensive system with Tippett. How quick is he in the AHL?
I think he's
in the AHL by the All-Star break.
Well, again, we'll see how that works out, but I know this about the player going back to Ottawa. The last time we had a player on paper that looked like a great big steal for the Ottawa Senators, he was headed to Russia months later. So let's remember what potential looks like versus what the actual player looks like. Yes, on paper, Kyle Turris in that lineup, in a different situation, away from Phoenix. Hey, maybe he turns into the player he thinks he's going to be. Or maybe he doesn't, and we'll see what happens. Last thing for me on headlines, sir. Joel Quenneville wins game number 600 as an NHL coach. Where does Joel Quenneville rank for you right now in active NHL coaches?
I love him, and for me, Joel Quenneville is right up around the top. And ask anyone who's... First of all, he has the best death stare in the NHL. Can you think of a coach that has a better death stare than
yes.
Joel Quenneville? Who?
Mike Babcock, hands down, no questions asked.
Oh, I'll take Quenneville in the death stare. That would be an... Oh, God, how great of a fight poster would that be? Joel Quenneville versus Mike Babcock. The stare-down fight poster? Oh, God, that'd be
Get
awesome.
At it, Puck Daddy readers.
I'm
you want
exactly.
that for the next Chicago-Detroit game.
That's one for Puck Daddy. I think for me, Joel Quenneville is right up around the top. And I think he got hosed when he lost the gig in Colorado because he took a ragtag bunch into the playoffs. Sure, they flamed out, but that team had no business being in the playoffs, and Quenneville got him there. Was really happy for Joel Quenneville when the Chicago Black. A lot of people are like, hey, I'm happy for Hossa, I'm happy for Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane. No, I was happy for Joel Quenneville.
I'll go top five. I'd put him fifth. I put Babcock, Trotz, Tippett, Bylsma ahead of him, and I put him like fifth, I think.
You'd put Trotz over Bylsma?
Yeah.
Really? Eh? Why?
Well, because the size of their toy chests.
Yeah, but I mean, Bylsma's toy chest was empty last year. They're all in the hospital. He's still
you
got
have
100
to,
points.
I agree, sir. But I think Trotz, the job that Trotz has done year after year with that team has been remarkable.
I agree. I'm not disagreeing. I'm kind of surprised you put him ahead of Dan Bylsma. He probably takes a better one-timer than Dan Bylsma.
Neither here nor there. I mean, they're both in the top five. It's not like I put them behind, you know.
No, Greg, this is sports radio. I have to be mad about everything.
It's not like I put them behind that unilingual Anglophone Randy Cunnywort.
Stupid English pig with no brains.
That's the problem with that guy is I can't even say it's Cunnywort. It's Cunnywort at the end.
Is that like how they used to make in the three stars at the old forum? They used to try to make every English name sound French. La deuxième étoile, Dale Hunter. And if it was European, they try to make it sound French. Et la troisième étoile, the third star, Peter Svoboda. Even if they're not from there, you gotta make it sound like they are. That was the old forum.
Doug,
God bless them.
Doug Uda. All right, that was your Puck headlines. To close out the show, we had a question
Letty
of the day.
Robinson.
We had a question of the day talking about the laziest nicknames for a player on your team or in the NHL in general. We're talking about, you know, there's been great nicknames, there's fantastic nicknames, and then there's lazy nicknames, and we're looking for the lazy nicknames, like
Ian,
this one.
Okay, go.
Oh, go ahead. We're going to both get the same one.
Ian W., probably Cabby for Habby Boolin. Laziest nickname goes, that one was from Ian M. This one from Brad Spencer. Laziest nickname goes to Captain Zach Parise. Seems lazy just to give him the nickname for a couple of months. Hashtag trade. Sorry, Greg.
Runs on Duncan, aka Cat. Really good, Tumblr, by the way. Kaner, Sharpie, Bowley. The Blackhawks are not creative at all when it comes to nicknames. We have seen a multitude of Kaners. West French, Kaner. Though fun to yell, it's about as lazy as nicknames get.
What else do we have here? Oh, hey, Mark Pargas. Yeah, Claude Richard was Vest Pocket Rocket. Thank you. That was from earlier on. Thank you. Much appreciated. A lot of, you know, if you just end it with a Y that people consider need cooler names. Oh, Douglas. I didn't know this. Mike Vellucci sends in cooler nicknames. You know what Douglas Murray's nickname is? I didn't know this. It's a cool nickname.
Oh, it's, no, go ahead and say it.
Crankshaft.
No, I didn't know that.
Crankshaft, apparently, that's his nickname. I still think, well, you know, San Jose's got a cool, Mark Edward Vlasic is Pickles.
Pickles.
I think that's a pretty cool
one
nickname.
One of the best nicknames in the whole league, yeah, for sure.
Pickles is great. And then, down the street in Los Angeles, I still maintain that, Kyle Clifford's nickname, the Colonel, because his middle name is Frank, so initials KFC. I think the Colonel is a great nickname out there. That's for Kyle Clifford, folks.
Virginia writes in, don't know what happened to him, but some people here in Edmonton called Grebishkov Garbage Cough, which shortened into garbage.
Ooh, ooh, that's wow, that's tough. Hey, and you wonder too, like Ken Linsman, for example, his nickname was The Rat.
Uh-huh.
And that's given to you by other people around the NHL. Like most players, I'm sure they don't mind their nickname. They kind of like it, probably. Hey, it's my nickname. Yeah, it's the boys call me. Then there are just some. I can't imagine Ken Linsman ever enjoyed being called the Rats. Like, you know, when you bring someone on the program, like, hey, we're welcoming to the program here, Greg Yashinsky. For the first time, he was a Flyers tough guy. He was a Los Angeles Kings tough guy. He was a Pittsburgh Penguins tough guy. Dave the Hammer Schultz. Like, I'm sure Schultz, he kind of likes that, right? He likes being called Dave the Hammer. I can't imagine. Well, you know, he broke new ground. He was the first to challenge the 20-year-old draft rule in the National Hockey League, and that's why 18-year-olds are playing. Please welcome to the program controversial forward for the Philadelphia Flyers and Boston Bruins, amongst other teams in the NHL, Ken the Rat Linsman. I can't imagine enjoy being called.
Well, there's the dude from the Rangers, Matt Zuccarello. His nickname is the Hobbit Wizard.
Yeah.
Everybody calls him the Hobbit Wizard. If you say Hobbit Wizard, hockey fans, what you're talking about, hates it. Hates the nickname.
Really?
Yeah,
well, because I would imagine that Ray Whitney in Phoenix loves the nickname the Wizard. And dude,
totally.
Man,
another guy who hates his nickname, Brad Marchand. This is from Casey Downey. Marchmont for Brad Marchand. Boy, he really doesn't like that one, is the hashtag.
Really?
Hmm. Yeah.
Hey, dude!
Stuck with a nickname you don't like. Yeah.
Tyler Eves tweets in. You ready for this, bro? We're lobbying for DJs. Tyler Eves tweets in, and yes, Tyler, I'm going to get you these. Says, if you can get me sound clips, I can put some cheesy beats behind them. Done and done. Elena, hook it up.
There's going to be more isolation than the national sovereignty of Switzerland on this show. Let's see here. Mark Cole writes in, I love when Eastern European players get Americanized names. Favorite, Vaclav Prospel becomes Vinny. You've got a favorite one of those, too, from a guy who used to be in Columbus and is now in Philly.
Got, I got a couple, and it seems that Columbus cornered the market on this. What is it about Columbus? You can't pronounce European names? Jakub Voracek became Jake Voracek. But the best one, Rutislav Klesla. God bless him. Somewhere, Stan Butler, if you listen, did a good job with him in the Brampton Battalion of the OHL. All of a sudden, Rutislav Klesla became Rusty Klesla.
Oh, and this one,
European names, eh, Columbus?
This one from Mark Pargas is fantastic, and I hate this about hockey nicknames. G for Claude Giroux. And how many dudes are named nicknamed Z? If your last name begins with a Z, your nickname is Z. Come on, man.
I know, that's
lazy.
That's lazy. Lazy town. That's lazy. I pine for the days of the Chicoutimi cucumber. Those are the great ones. Chicoutimi cucumber.
George real Vesna. Quick.
God bless him.
Real quick here before we close up shop.
Bun Cook. Oh, there's another great.
As we speak, sir.
Yes.
The Florida Panthers and the St. Louis Blues both have 42 points on December 19th. That is astounding.
Yes. Yes, it is, Greg Wyshynski. Who finishes the season higher?
Oh, boy. I'd go Florida. Southeast Division, moxie there.
I was gonna say Team Cat, but then I look at the St. Louis Blues and I say I still think there's more talent on St. It's a tougher conference. Make no mistake about it. It's a tougher conference
is why I said.
I think St. Louis is a better team, but I think Team Cat finishes higher. So I go Team Cat.
God. Florida Panthers. The Florida Panthers.
I believe now, man. I believe now.
I believe in them too. I mean, Versteeg with the overtime game winner on Sunday. And again, like I've been saying about them, if they get into a funk, they've got three goalies they can throw in there that are capable of getting on a little run. Clemenson and Markstrom can both get on a run too.
One that dances.
Oh, did you see that on Puck Daddy today?
Awesome. I love that. Dancing goalie.
Markstrom down in San Antonio dancing to the Venga Boys, We Like to Party. And it's the glass breaks, right? So the goalie's trying to just keep loose. And he just starts dancing. He does the cabbage patch with his goalie stick. I thought that was a pretty talented move right there.
I think
that's the show for today. Thanks again to our guest, Jason Farris, who wrote, Behind the Moves. And you can find his book, where, Merrick?
Was it NHLGMs.com. That's where you can find Jason Farris's fine book, Behind the Moves, NHL General Managers Tell How Winners Are Built. I give this the... Do we have a rating system here for the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast?
Like a two thumbs up? No, go ahead.
I don't know. We need to come up with something that is self-referential and possibly self-deprecating as well. We need
a
rating
system.
It's
a scale of like 1 to 10. With
1 to 10
one
something.
Being...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's like a scale of 1 to 10 with 1 being a book written by... A mascot. Although, actually, that'd be a hell of a book. I take it back.
Oh, you know what? I got a friend of mine after Men's League, my buddy Tommy Goff, who listens to the program religiously, had an idea for you for Puck Daddy and probably for the podcast involving one of your, something that's near and dear to your heart. We could probably do it on the podcast too. Mascot Showdown.
Nice.
I'll tell you at a later date, but Tom Goff came with a good, it might have just been the Ales talking on Saturday, but I was pretty convinced he had a good idea.
Oh, speaking of the Ales, if you do have an IMAX theater near you, you've got to check out the new Mission Impossible flick. It's the real deal. It's the real McCoy. It's solid. It's probably the best of the series. And the action set pieces, man, like him climbing that building in Dubai, that's wiener shrinking time. That is a hell of an action set.
How was the trailer though?
Oh, Batman?
Yeah.
Amazing. It was amazing. Yeah. Well, I saw the prologue, the 6-minute prologue, that featured Bane and this amazing escape that I can't say anything more, but it was, if you haven't seen it, it's an escape that occurs in the air between two planes. It's ridiculous.
Ooh.
The Batman trailer is online now. You can see it and your mind's going to be blown. Like the first one was the sort of personal journey. It was almost like a kung fu movie. The second one was sort of like Christopher Nolan redoing Heat. It was like his own version of like a cop and robbers movie. This third one, it looks like Lord of the Rings. It's like epic. It's like a giant epic. Oh my God. It's ridiculous. So do check that out if you can. I am Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick here from Sportsnet. Tonight I will be handling the affairs for Edmonton and Detroit this evening. That is my one job to do today.
And oh, by the way,
we're on Facebook. We're on Facebook tonight. Hey,
yeah.
We're on Facebook, Greg. Marek versus Wyszynski. Check it out.
Please
we're
do.
Gonna be, I mean, it's bare bones right now. We're going to be adding more stuff to it daily. Links and pictures and content and commentary.
Absolutely.
And you know what I love? What I love about our first Facebook post? Can I tell you this?
Yes.
Yep. Our first Facebook post. Like, as soon as I put it up, the first comment came from Petter Cranbro from Sweden.
Please be our friend. And yeah. Fellas, wiener pictures. You know, we don't discriminate. you got a wiener picture to share. You can share it with us. It's fine. I'll be watching hockey and also celebrating the U.S. championship reign of one Zack Ryder on Monday Night Raw. Woo-woo. You know it.
Hey, I had brunch yesterday with Lance Storm. Did I tell you that?
No! What?
Yeah.
That should be the first thing you say to me. Oh, I was just having a bite with an ECW legend.
Oh, man, it was great. We're talking all the
priorities.
I've known Lance for years. Like, going back to, like, 97, back when he was with ECW. We talked. Maybe we'll do it on the podcast. My lunch with Lance. Yes, he's in town. And so me and Claire and TJ went out just up the street here. He's on his way back.
Well, I had sushi with Sabu. So
sushi with Sabu. We talked about Eddie Farhad, his uncle. Sushi with Sabu. See, I got high with Rob Van Dam. Everyone's gotten high with Rob Van Dam. Ain't that special, yo. Ain't that special. Thank you.